many, many times. So I'm familiar with this room, in fact. And the topic that I'm going to present this evening is I presented once before, and that was while I was in Detroit. It was around Christmas time, 2 years ago, and there was a gentleman from South India who was promoting a world peace event. Had a week-long gathering of people, and somehow I was asked to be a co-presenter along with this gentleman, who is primarily a Buddhist, but kind of like a Gandhian Buddhist, which fits and doesn't fit at the same time. And his organization is based in Sri Lanka, and he has a very large number of villages in that country where they're working towards sustainability. In Sri Lanka, there's lots of tension, hostility, violence, government, anti-government, and lots of turmoil. So Gandhian Buddhist approach is, you know, appreciated by a lot of people. So at that event, I was asked to be the first speaker, and I felt it would be a very nice thing to do to provide you with a copy of something that my spiritual master wrote during the Vietnamese War, where there was a strong call amongst the college and young educated persons calling for peace. So he wrote an essay, The Peace Formula. If I give it out now, you'll not pay attention to what I'm saying, so I'll give it out later. But make sure you get one before you go. Can't hear? What do I do? Hold it like this. I can do that. I can do that. I don't mind. You're going to get a front row seat? Okay. Okay. The little abstract that was sent out spoke about the conventional sense of peace. And a conventional sense of peace has to do with, in Vedic language, the qualities of goodness. How many are not familiar with Bhagavad Gita? Bhagavad Gita, okay. Bhagavad Gita is over there. I'll make reference to it several times. In Bhagavad Gita, it speaks about material nature and how material nature is conducted by three primary modes of nature: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Or the principles of creation is passion, destruction is ignorance, and sustenance or maintenance is goodness. Of the three modes of nature, they're always in competition. Even if one may be prominent, the other two are recessive and competing for supremacy, and sometimes a very good person may exhibit anger, and then that will subside because the modes are competing and sometimes one is above the others. So with that view in mind, the Bhagavad Gita picture of the modes of nature, or Vedic picture of the modes of nature that are active. The mode of goodness promotes peace, and features of the mode of goodness include tolerance, humility, forgiveness, good qualities. So if this nice lady, I wasn't paying attention, I'm walking by and she kicked me in the leg, she wouldn't do that. But if she did that, I could, you know, become angry. And we just lost our tranquility and peace because I'm responding, reacting to something that, you know, but maybe I was about to step on her injured foot and she was just protecting her injured foot and didn't have a chance to say, you know, stop. So just did it a different way. And maybe it was the right thing to do and I just didn't understand the signal. So I... something. So without the quality of goodness present, we can easily get into the dog and cat fight program of he did this to me, she did this to me, and back and forth. And so it's a message of Bhagavad Gita. One of the first messages, in fact, of Bhagavad Gita is the Sanskrit word is titikshava or titiksha, tolerate. There's us, and there's the world outside of us, and the world outside of us has duality. Sometimes, just like you're hearing, you know, in a couple of weeks it's going to start getting very cold, and then winter comes, and that's a nice warm day, and then it's cold, and then it's biting cold. And what do you do when it's very hot or very cold? You make external arrangements, but you tolerate because there's nothing you can do about it. But so you tolerate it. Matra sparsha stukonte ya sitoshna sukha dukada agama panyonya just tang satiksha swabharata. Krishna's advice is it's a quality of goodness. So rise above the lower mode of nature by the quality of goodness. Tolerate. If something happens that disturbed you, you tolerate it. The source of it, you extend forgiveness. Another, it's from the Vedic perspective, but it's found in all religious teachings of the world, forgiveness. Bhishma Dev, an example of this from the Vedic perspective, is he gives a teaching how to develop good qualities. So if there's this lower quality that's anger, you forgive. And not only you forgive, you forget. Don't forgive in it, but hold on to it. That's not complete. You forget. Let go. And be situated in kindness and compassion and so forth. So those are qualities of goodness. But the approach that I'm going to take is a step above that, or a transcendental approach, where the peace formula, this paper that I'm going to hand out in a moment, comes from this verse of Bhagavad Gita. If the light could go down, that would be better. If you care to look this up later, it's the last verse of the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And Shanti is in the last line. Gyatvamam Shanti. Shanti means peace. So Krishna is explaining how one can achieve peace from the pangs of material miseries. So three principles. Bhoktaram yagyatapasam. Yagya means sacrifice. And there's the classic form of sacrifice that some of you are familiar with if you're from India, or just in principle, sacrifice means to literally render something sacred, to offer something unto the Supreme. So we're all making some sacrifice to attend the university. You're not doing some other things so that you can do these things. And there's some purpose in that sacrifice. So whatever it is that we do in life, it involves sacrifice. The message that Krishna is presenting is perform that sacrifice for the Supreme. Whatever that sacrifice is, it involves other people on this plane, but let those interactions be a sacrifice for the satisfaction of the Supreme. Then, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. Sarvaloka means all planets, all of the material creation. There's one person who is the supreme controller or proprietor, and that's to be recognized. If we can recognize who does everything belong to, you'll see there's a little excerpt from this peace formula in the next, taken from what I'm going to pass out to you. Is the message here is about proprietorship. That's the second line. Who does everything belong to? In some of you may be familiar with the Upanishads. Maybe that's more familiar than Bhagavad Gita for some persons. So the Upanishads, they're parts of the Vedas, and there's 108 principal Upanishads, and the first one of them speaks about proprietorship. The concept of proprietorship can make people be at odds with each other. This person thinks it's mine, and the other person thinks it's mine, and they have dispute over whose it is. And it's, you know, whether it's the capitalist and the laborer, or the communist who says everything belongs to the state, or the socialist, or, you know, the different political ideologies for that matter have a lot to do with who is the proprietor. So this middle line is to recognize there's one proprietor of everything, and that's the Supreme Lord, Supreme God. He's the proprietor. We may have secondary proprietorship, or we're given some responsibility over certain set of things for a little while, like this body. We say my body, but there was a time when it wasn't my body, it was other elements in some other configuration, and after some time it's also going to be something else. But we say my body, so we're the secondary proprietor. Or my shoes, or my intelligence, my ability. Sometime we didn't have some ability, and sometime, after some time, everything is going to be taken away from us. So who does it belong to? With thinking like that, something, that there's an original proprietor of all things, and recognizing the original proprietor, I don't have to be in big anxiety about making things mine. It's already belonging to someone. I just recognize that, and I become peaceful. And suhrid, benefactor, a well-wisher. Everyone's well-wishing friend is that same person who is the enjoyer of all sacrifice, the proprietor of everything, and the well-wishing friend of everyone. One who can understand those three things can be peaceful. They can, and can overcome all of the miseries of material existence. Here's a little quote from that essay. This earth is, therefore, the property of God. But we, the living entities, especially the so-called civilized human beings, are claiming God's property as our own under both an individual and collective false conception. If you want peace, you have to remove this false conception from your mind and from the world. This false claim of proprietorship by the human race on earth is partly or wholly the cause of disturbances, all disturbances of peace on earth. So, placing the central point of all existence within the Supreme. Nice picture of a beautiful lotus. In Vedic culture, the lotus is a symbol of perfection, of beauty, and peace, like our Western culture has a dove or something like that. One of the first, I want to share something with you. One of the first lectures that I heard my spiritual master speak was on a picture of what you see here on the screen, because he had recently come from India, and I wasn't accustomed to hearing his accent or his way of speech. He was speaking English, fine English, but I just couldn't understand. So I heard the lecture and had to hear it again and again and again to be very clear what he was saying. So because I heard it so many times, it made a very strong impression. So here's what was described. He made a motion like this and said, imagine there's a lake, a pond of water in the middle here, the middle of the floor. And we gave each person a little pebble. And after distributing the pebbles, we could say, okay, could you place your pebble inside the lake and the pond and let's see what happens. And this is what would happen. A little splash and concentric circles would expand out. And it's very geometrically attractive. And then someone else can place their pebble in the pond and see what happens. And the same thing happens. The concentric circles expand. But as those concentric circles expand, at some point, they intersect. And then there's a little clash of the concentric circles. So then imagine, on the count of three, everyone else throw your pebbles into the pond. Let's see what happens. It's called material life. Big chaotic thing all over the surface of the pond because so many clashes, nice concentric circles, geometrically very attractive, clashing with one another. And then he described, imagine if everyone agreed that one central point would be the place where they would put their pebble. One, two, three. They place the pebble in that spot. And there's not a clash. We don't lose our individual pebbleness, our individual quality, but rather the individual nature of each of us can complement and amplify what another individual has to offer. And this was his teaching, or by example, that we need to find, not arbitrarily, but in a very holistic way, in a natural way, what is the center of all existence. And I'll share another little anecdote with you that matches this. The punchline is that you cannot arbitrarily just pick a center, because after some time, if the center is artificial or arbitrary, if it's not of our real essence, then you'll get the mix again. So one time, just like to visit here, I came from New York City on a train that came from Penn Station, New York City. I don't know if any of you have taken the train back and forth, but it went from Penn Station to Philadelphia, South Street Station. They, decoupled the train, and then the train continued and went through Harrisburg up to Lewistown, and I got off in Lewistown and came here to State College. So I was doing the same thing some time back. And riding trains is very peaceful. It's much better than airplanes, depending on the distance you have to go. So we went from Penn Station to Philadelphia, South Street. Everything was fine. And then everybody got in. It was really full that day. I can't remember exactly the reason why, but it was really full. And I was on an aisle seat, and the seat next to me was open, and so a nice lady asked, is anybody sitting there? I said, no, fine, you can sit there. So she sat down. And I was busy doing my thing. And after some time, I picked up this vibration that she wanted to talk. Some people like to talk and some people like to be quiet. She was the like to talk kind of a person. And she was wearing a shawl. We say Harinam Chadar. She was wearing a traditional Indian shawl. And so that told me she knew something about India. Maybe she had been to India or something like that, and she wanted to have some dialogue about that. So she asked, are you with an ashram? And I thought, wow, she not only knows about India, she knows the word ashram. And I said, yes. And she said, I lived in an ashram. I said, okay. And what? Tell me, what was that? What was that ashram? Where was it? She said, West Virginia. And I thought, wow, because we have an ashram also in West Virginia, maybe it's the same one. I said, okay, what ashram was that? He said, something, something yoga, ashram. Oh, how long ago was that? Oh, it was about 30 years ago. And she's, you know, very happy to talk. So I just let her go. And what was that like? She said, oh, how long did you stay there? She said, I stayed there for about 3 or 4 years. You know, it was everybody got together with a, you know, a particular vision. And you know what happened after some years? The vision kind of started to fade, and this person wanted to do it this way, and that person wanted to do it that way, and the other person wanted to do it another way, and it kind of like, you know, fell apart. At all. Then what did you do? I moved to New York and joined another ashram. And there I learned more yoga practice. And then I, after some time, I moved back to Philadelphia, where my family is from, and now I'm on my way to go visit my friend in Harrisburg. I said, oh. And then she said, are you going to an ashram? And I said, yes. And what ashram is that? I said, it's the Hare Krishna place. It's a country ashram in Port Royal, Pennsylvania. I said, I don't know where that is. I said, it's near Lewistown. Oh, Lewistown. Oh, I know what that is. So then I shared with her the difference between something that's a center that's arbitrarily picked and a center that's factual, like what is the source of everything? Because the source of everything is the absolute truth. That from which everything comes, this is Vedanta, as in Vedanta Sutra, that from which everything comes, other things may be truths, but those truths are relative or subordinate to or dependent upon the source of emanation of all things. So if you don't pick as your center, you know, people, a group of people may get together and agree upon something, whatever that something is, an ism or an ideal or a virtue or something that they value. And they get together for that purpose, and they have some association or some assembly or some organization or something. That which is going to be permanent, in contrast with impermanent, is something where the center is actually genuine or like on a spiritual plane, eternally a reality. So when you have this situation, you're going to have a clash when it comes between two people, just as in physical nature. So what we don't want is that. What we want is this. And a center that's actually a genuine center. A teaching from the Vedas, very simple, is if you want to nourish a tree, give water to a tree, you could try putting water in the branches and the leaves and the twigs and the fruits and the flowers and all the trunk and all the big limbs of the tree and all the parts of the tree. You can try doing like that, or you can just put water on the root. And if you put water on the root of the tree, then water goes to all the parts of the tree. And that's the natural way that the tree is receiving nourishment. So similarly, if you can find the root of all existence, that center from which we've all emanated and that all things have emanated, and place our attention, our ability, our energy, our intelligence, our whatever capacity that we have, whatever resource that we have upon that center, then benefit is automatically or it's naturally distributed to all the parts of the tree of life, or the existence that comes from God. This is the logo or the banner that this gentleman promoted, and of course promoting his One Piece program. So I'll share one other thing that happened during this dialogue. In the audience was, I was a speaker and this gentleman was a speaker. In the audience was an author that I happen to know personally. One of the things that's his causes is vegetarianism. So he spoke, he asked a question of the other gentleman, the other speaker, and said, "You're a Buddhist, and Buddhists, at least, you know, traditional Buddhism, believes in nonviolence. And one of the ways to promote peace, just as Gandhi borrowed that notion of nonviolent cooperation in order to bring change in a peaceful way. So since Buddhism is something that you resonate with, it's not exactly teaching Buddhism, but it's something that you, it works well within what you're doing. My question is vegetarianism something that you're promoting? Because if we can't be kind to the other living beings around us, like the animals that the Bible teaches and all scripture teaches that we have custody of, or man was given, what's the word from the Old Testament? Dominion. Man was given dominion over the animals by God. So those that we have dominion over, if we can't protect them, then how are we going to have peace? How are we going to promote peace successfully? And the gentleman said, he waffled. He said, "Well, in an ideal world, that would be very nice. But if you're going to promote, here's my point, if you're going to promote peace, at least according to this conception of Bhagavad Gita, it has to be on the spiritual plane. And on the spiritual plane, that which animates every living entity, every body, every form of life, is spirit soul. And a spirit soul is part of God. And because all spirit souls are part of God, they're to be respected. Not just my group." As soon as you have groupism, then you have conflict. Because my group means it's not part of that group. So it could be racial. It could be religious. It can be national. It can be ethnic. It can be all kinds of things, this group, that group. And how do you get free from groupism? By coming to a higher platform of recognizing the universal spiritual value, merit of every living being. And if you value life because of that spiritual quality that's within the heart of every living being, then you respect all forms of life. The converse is, you're going to have conflict because you're going to have groups. My group versus another group. To assist in awakening that spiritual consciousness, there's a practice, or a in Sanskrit, sadhana, something that one can do that directly awakens the original consciousness of the soul. Those of you that are familiar with Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Pratyaksha avagamam dharmyam susukam kartam avyayam." Pratyaksha means direct perception. This practice is meant to give us direct perception of our spiritual identity. Not like, I hope it's true, or a wishful thinking, like, maybe after this life I'll find out if it's true or not. But one can directly perceive the presence of the soul. And there's a sadhana, or there's a practice. And part of this practice is this chanting of mantra. So I'm going to introduce a little bit what mantra chanting is. In the abstract that was sent out, the language was used, you know, rather than simply trying to have a behavior that says, I'll be tolerant, I'll be forgiving, that this is something out there, this approach is something that's in here, and something that's in here is my real identity. My real identity is this animating conscious being that's within the gross physical body. The gross physical body will perish. It came into being and it's going to go out of being, but I'm going to continue to exist. And who is that me who is animating this body is the seat of consciousness and will continue to exist beyond this body. And mantra is a nice little metaphor. Is it's like taking a match and striking the match against the match box, the striker. And the fire that's stored in the match comes out. But unless you move it across the striker, it can sit in the matchbox for a long time. Years and years and years and indefinite period of time. Sometime it'll deteriorate. But the fire is nonetheless stored. Moving it across the striker, the fire comes out. Similarly, mantra is a spiritual sound that awakens the dormant spiritual consciousness that's within the heart of every living being. And by calling upon that sacred sound, it awakens that dormant consciousness. Part of spiritual practice is this, I call this an alignment chart, where we're interested in awakening to our true identity of soul, but we also have to have the physical, mental, and the heart level in proper order and aligned so that one can go through these different gateways to enter into the inner chamber where the soul is. And ultimately, you see in the drawing, there's a key. And the inside of the key is that soul inside the person. And the person inside the person is the form of this supreme soul. Like the Bible teaches, the kingdom of God is within you. Same notion as from the Vedic perspective. There's a form, literally, a form of the supreme soul that's within the heart of every living being. And when there's proper alignment of our physical, mental, and heart makeup, then we can enter through those gates and come to the platform where we can come face to face with the supreme soul. There's a very simple practice that one can follow. And it's to bring one to that same position of recognizing these items of the peace formula. Who is the, when I'm making some sacrifice in my life, who is the real enjoyer of that? And worldly consciousness, material worldly consciousness, of course I'm the enjoyer. Why would I do something unless I'm the enjoyer of that something? But when there's love, you do something because the beloved is enjoying, and that's why I do something. So then the higher state of spiritual consciousness is where there's divine love. That loving propensity is reposed upon the supreme. And the good news is, because all living entities are parts and parcels of the supreme, then naturally that tendency of love for the supreme extends to all living entities. Naturally so, not by some mental adjustment, but it springs from the heart. It's from the inside, and it just comes out in one's practical dealings with others. And that's the platform of peace. If one can enter into that consciousness or awaken that consciousness from within, then one's life in human relations or in relation with nature or relation with all other living beings, whether they're human or not, becomes a peaceful one. Two other parts to this, and I'm going to end. There's very nice prayer, too, by Prahlad Maharaj. Those of you that are from India, you know who is Prahlad Maharaj. He was very pure and simple in heart, just a small boy, and his father was just the opposite. His father was as mean as can be, vicious, cruel, and with the terror of the universe, Hiranyakashipu. But in that simplicity, Prahlad was offering this prayer to Lord Nrisimhadeva, who is pictured here, as follows. May there be good fortune throughout the universe, and may all envious persons be pacified. May all living entities become calm by practicing bhakti yoga, for by accepting devotional service they will think of each other's welfare. Therefore, let us all engage in the service of the Supreme Transcendence, Lord Sri Krishna, and always remain absorbed in thought of Him. Very nice. This is from Srimad Bhagavatam, a prayer for peace. And following that, he offers a more formal mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Narasimhaya, where I offer my respectful obeisances unto Lord Nrisimhadeva, the source of all power. O my Lord, who possesses nails and teeth just like thunderbolts, kindly vanquish our demon-like desires for fruitive activity in this material world. Please appear in our hearts and drive away our ignorance so that by your mercy we may become fearless in the struggle for existence in this material world. The prayer for peace, one is for the welfare of others, but in our interactions with others, the thing that guides or moves our activity is our heart. And his appeal to Lord Nrisimhadeva is, please remove impurity from my heart. Specifically, fruitive mentioned is here. Desires for fruitive activity. Desires for fruitive activity means selfishness, simply. What I want is at the center. So then we have that same with the many concentric circles. Someone else is thinking, what I want is what's at the center. And everyone has a similar idea. And we can work together as long as we can tolerate one another's other-centeredness than our-centeredness. And when that is violated, we have conflict. But if that self-centeredness is removed and the God-centeredness becomes established, our hearts become peaceful and our relationships become peaceful. We don't become impersonal. We maintain our individuality, but our individuality is placed upon the Supreme and pleasing and satisfying the Supreme. So we strive to work cooperatively towards that end. Okay, so the last part of the presentation is a little video rendering that some friends put together, and I hope it works. So can you be ready to deal with the volume and see what happens? It's short. we have some time for questions. Any point you'd like to bring out in relation to the topic is fine.
You had this alignment of physical body, mind, heart and the soul.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little bit more?
Sure. Maybe we'll start with the mind because we become very involved with the mind a lot. If the mind is very disturbed or agitated or worried about something, it's hard to access a peaceful place within. Or if there's if the body is very tired or ill or in, you know, some difficult situation, a holistic approach of spiritual well-being is we have to eat properly, rest properly, exercise, take care of the body properly. We have to give the mind the right kinds of wholesome engagement and conversely keep the mind away from other things. The place where how we're organizing our emotional or the feeling content of our life, what things are important to us, our values, and staying true to our values is something that by putting those things in proper alignment, then it makes it easier, much easier, to access a spiritual dimension to our life. They're not exactly prerequisites, but it's natural in the holistic picture of life or who we are, although our real identity is spirit soul. These other things have to be in proper order. We need to give some time and attention to each of them and have some idea of how to do that. That's a short answer. Maybe a longer answer is somebody who you may know of, Satchinandana Swami. He's from Germany. He's been developing a whole institute for people that don't know, and really don't know too much of anything, but they have bits and pieces of this and that. And he's developing, the last 4 or 5 years, an institute that will use that same principle. So take people, you know, 101, and then 201, and 301, step by step, what are things that can be done to make for, you know, a well-being on the physical level, natural wellness of the body, healing by natural methods, and the mind, natural methods of peace and balance and free from disturbances by various methodologies, natural methodologies, and then, you know, the feeling content of our life and the values that we hold, all those things, and how to take advantage of them, not just so that I feel better or feel stronger or healthier or more fit, but towards that higher objective that they're meant for. The human form of life is meant for attaining that spiritual realization, self-realization, God-realization. A little bit longer explanation. So sometimes there's a focus on one aspect or another.
overshadowing the other ones. But each of them are important. Okay? Yes.
Thank you. This is with respect to the analogy of the lake and the pebbles being put in there.
Yeah.
So this is probably one level higher. Like previously, the case was pebbles being put in different places, so concentric, I mean, circles clash and problem. But even when people agree to put the pebble in the same place, they might actually put it at different times. Then they don't agree on the time at which they
That's
put it.
Okay. That's
so,
okay.
So it might not be, the synergy might not be there, so how can we?
It is the same principle that is observed. The same principle as experience. I'm just going back. When I was going to college, communes were very popular. But what this woman described about it, actually she didn't use the word ashram, she used the word a commune. A commune, whichever the accent was, commune or commune. So, different principles, just living from nature, like, or, anyway, without giving examples. So, if you have a genuine center as opposed to we commonly share an agreement on this is a principle that we share and we hold and we want to live together based upon this principle. It's not going to endure. But now your example, specific your question is, supposing it is a genuine center and someone comes in later, if the center from the spiritual dimension, the center isn't changing, the dynamic of harmony also hasn't changed. Our individuality is still preserved. That hasn't changed. The amplifying of our collective individuality is also not changed. The principle isn't changed. The metaphor is just to show by example, with a worldly example, what happens when there isn't a common center. Now we'll go to real life. In real life, is the timing of things is not what's critical. The principle is what's critical. What's the actual center of all existence? And from the Vedanta picture, the center of all existence is that from which everything comes, whatever that is. And whatever that is, that's the center. That's the, by Vedanta definition, that's the absolute truth, where everything else comes from. So if we accept, we by examination, investigation, whatever method we want to use, we find that from which everything comes, the timing is not at all critical. It's, what's critical is finding the center.
Thank you.
Okay.
I have one question.
Okay.
It almost seemed to me, and actually we saw in one of those mantras too, we saw it in one of the mantras also, it talked about this. And it almost appears to me that as long as I have fear, I will have a tendency to defend. And as long as I have this defensive tendency, it's very difficult to have peace. So fearlessness in relationship to peace, like how do they...
You said it very nicely. Okay. If I think my identity is this body, there's a fear that I may lose this body, or this body, which I think is me, may be harmed. So there's fear, and then there's defense based upon I'm this body. But if my conception is I'm spirit soul, spirit souls don't come into being and don't go out of being. Nothing can harm this body. Excuse me, nothing can harm the soul. Like in Socrates' teachings, I don't know the exact reference, but something to the effect where if you're not compliant with what, you know, the government wants, then they'll come to harass you and cause you great difficulty. And his reply was, first they'll have to catch me. Meaning, you can catch the body, but you can't catch the soul. It's, if you don't identify with the body, what's there to fear? What can be taken from you? Something that's, oh, I'm not. Illusion, that which is illusory can be, someone can try, but it can't touch you. So that the position, like, you know, they have those little cartoonish, you know, no fear. That's a bluff. You know, a spirit of the spirit of chivalry or competition. You know, people like combat. They're not afraid of combat. They like combat. They like, you know, body combat or whatever, fight or war, or, you know, they relish it. But the moment of death is the same for everyone. That which, if it's what I think that I am, this covering, the body, it's fearful. But when that misconception is taken away, or when the true identity is understood, that it can't be touched by anything. It's one of the early teachings of Bhagavad Gita. The soul cannot be cut by any weapon, moistened by water, withered by wind. No, it's not permeable by material elements. Then there's a position of safety from whatever may happen outside in the world of duality. We're protected and safe. There's shelter. There's nothing at risk. Anything else? Yes.
Thank you, Mark. I had a question about those concentric circles. How that common center comes into the dynamics of the daily relationships with, like, family, friends, by two assumptions. One assumption being that the other person also believes to that common center, and the other assumption is that the other guy.
First of all, it's not a matter of I believe and I don't believe, or someone believes and they don't believe. It's beyond belief. It's a reality. The center of all existence is the center of all existence, whether I know it or don't know it, believe it or don't believe it. If I act in that consciousness, I can remain peaceful. Even in circumstances where others have a very different point of view. Take, for example, Prahlad. He understood that centeredness, and his father didn't. He remained peaceful. His father was very aggressive, viciously aggressive, but he remained very peaceful. Just as an example. Or Socrates as an example. The people that were after him, they were very aggressive. They were concerned because he was so popular, they couldn't just, like, do away with him. But he was not afraid. Okay? And similarly for ourselves, it's not dependent, you know, our level of realization may be quite limited, but the principle doesn't change. one can live in this complicated world and remain very peaceful and feel protected and safe if that connection with the Supreme is very clear. And it's not simply a matter of believing it, it's a matter of being there or having that experience. And one who has that experience, it's very helpful in inviting others into that same space, that same experience. Okay? Anything else? Okay. Well, I guess it's time for prasadam, right? Okay. Okay, well, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.